finishing touches matter, don't they? You know, the meal is cooked, but how it's presented counts, at least to the chef. The painting looks finished, but those last touches make a difference, at least in the artist's eyes. The essays reach the last full stop, but many of us know the value of that final look through and how it saved us from some awful howler there, or we've spotted better ways of putting it here. Well, it's a little like that here in the book of Joshua. The battles are won, the enemies are defeated, the land is divided, but God still has some finishing touches to add before he signs off, as he does at the end of chapter 21, every promise fulfilled. Now, that chapter 21 sees the tribe of Levi, for example, the priestly tribe, given their place, a right to live in cities, a pasturing that would meet their needs. They're scattered across the tribes because we need to think of priests not just as those who offered sacrifices in the tabernacle and later the temple, but their job was also to teach and to hold the people to their God and to the covenant agreement, the promises people had. Oh, our eyes will race over the details of a chapter like this, but they're a vital ingredient for the healthy future of this community. And chapter 20 seems at first sight even stranger, a detail to add to the provisions people will have in their legal system and their justice structures. Why are we told these? Well, think for a moment. Justice, or lack of it, tells you a lot about a nation, about its character, about its values. I mean, justice has been in the news this week in several places, hasn't it? In India, those two women gang-raped and hanged to death on a tree, and the police not responding, according to reports, because they were of too low a caste. Pakistan, a woman stoned to death in an honor killing outside the High Court in the center of the city of Lahore, and no one intervened. And the BBC reporter spoke of thousands of honor killings a year in the country and virtually no one prosecuted for them. And what does that signal, she said? It signals it's okay to do it. Perhaps most strikingly in the headlines in the last 48 hours has been the Sudan and the woman sentenced to 100 lashes and the death penalty. And if reports are to be believed, she was brought up by her Christian mother. She married a Christian man, but the court deemed that she had the Muslim religion of her absent father, and because she won't renounce Christ, she's been convicted of apostasy. And the international outcry has been so strong that they say she will now be released. And you know, meanwhile, in this country, it doesn't have to be abroad. We've got a saying, haven't we? One rule for the rich, another for the poor. And that's not always aimed at other nations. We have a growing parallel legal system in the UK of Sharia courts and councils, and their values, particularly in the role of women, are insidiously becoming standard practice in growing numbers of Muslim communities here. So what does God reveal of himself and his values and his priorities as he opens this tiny window into a very basic legal system and builds into it these cities of refuge? Well, I think the first thing they speak of is God's justice. Justice matters. I mean, that idea is rooted in our psyches, isn't it? This call for justice. We see it time and again in some of our major court cases when a conviction is secured and someone official stands outside the court afterwards and says something along the lines of, "Justice has been done today, and we hope that'll help the family find closure." We feel it perhaps even more in unsolved cases, whether it's murders like Stephen Lawrence's or sex abusers, as in so many recent instances, decades without perpetrators being brought to justice and the damage that causes. Well, God's law for his people was clear about justice, starkly so. Whoever sheds human blood, by humans shall their blood be shed, Genesis 9:6. You are to take life for life, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, Exodus 21 says. And while it's clearly limiting the retribution, it's also putting significant value on what damage has been done. We can debate issues of capital punishment on a day when we've more time, but it's clear, isn't it? This is not to be a society where you can murder with impunity. It's not intended that families should face the seething resentment of no justice done on top of the agonies of brutal loss and bereavement. And in a rural society with no police force, it's clear that the role of the avenger of blood, you saw he's mentioned in verse 3 and 5 and 9, his role is to ensure that justice is done, that murder faces its deserved retribution. Now, you don't need a lot of imagination. It's not hard to realize how easy that idea can become corrupted, how the idea of blood vengeance can turn into the kind of feuds that plague countries like Albania, for example. They say there are thousands unable to go out in their villages because of tit-for-tat killings between families that have gone on and on down the generations. Mark Mennell, who visits Albania a number of times for Langham Partnership, met with a pastor who was shot and gunned down, killed just a couple of years back on the receiving end of one of these tit-for-tat blood feuds. His widow, he told me, has managed to persuade the males in her family not to continue it. It's easy, too, for the avenger of blood to become trigger-happy. Yeah, justice matters, but it must be just. And you read this chapter and you're struck by a God who understands that, who looks at the heart of the perpetrator and not just the corpse of the victim, who understands that not all killings are deliberate and provides for them. So each time the avenger of blood is mentioned, there's also talk of someone who kills a person accidentally. They're there in verse 3 and 5 and 9. And the cities of refuge are designed for them. A haven you can flee to and be safe from the avenger. A place provided to enable justice to be done in the case of accident. A God who knows there are times when justice can be more complex than simply a life for a life. Accidents do happen. I mean, the Bible gives some for examples. For example, what if you're chopping wood and the head of the axe flies off and strikes someone and kills them? Or what if you push a stone and it rolls down over a cliff and it crushes someone you didn't even realize was down there? Well, the Bible tells us cities of refuge were designed for those kinds of accidents. Flee there. And verse 5, even if the avenger of blood comes in pursuit, the elders must not surrender the fugitive. Now, it's not just some legal loophole, a legal way to escape justice, because they have to, verse 4, state their case before the elders of that city to gain admittance. They have to, verse 6, stand trial before the assembly. We're before the days of CSI, of course. I mean, there's no forensic science then, but you still needed evidence to convict of murder. You needed a witness. No, that wouldn't be good enough. You needed witnesses, more than one. Dale Ralph Davis, the American Bible teacher and commentator, sums up the purpose of these cities like this. He says, "A man without a murderer's heart should not suffer a murderer's punishment." In British criminal law today, many crimes need a guilty mind as well as a guilty act to secure conviction. A man without a murderer's heart should not suffer a murderer's punishment. So built into the legal system were these cities of refuge designed to protect justice in the face of accidents. Now, of course, to be effective, justice must be just, but also accessible. I mean, today's arguments in British law about accessibility revolve around things like representation and the provision of legal aid. But here, this basic system met the need for access by a fair and even spread of the cities. There were six in all. They were either side of the River Jordan, which flowed down the middle of the country. You could find them in the north, in the Midlands, in the south. Any fugitive had every chance of getting to one. In fact, one writer hundreds of years later wrote of the roads leading to the cities being kept in good repair, of every river bridged, of every turning with a signpost pointing to refuge so as not to slow down the fugitive. Well, certainly that's the kind of idea behind it. And did you notice who this refuge was for? Look at verse 9. Any of the Israelites or any foreigner residing among them who killed someone accidentally. See, no Little Englander mentality where the foreigners are second rate. No question of whether you were of the right caste or not. None of this one rule for the rich, another for the poor. Any of. As the old chorus puts it, there is a wideness to God's mercy. And even his idea of justice is shot through with it. The cities of refuge, they speak of God's justice. The cities of refuge speak also of God's values. See, what comes across loud and clear as you read this chapter is the value put on human life. Genesis 9 verse 6 explains why. Whoever sheds human blood, by human shall their blood be shed, it says. And then it goes on, for. Here's why. For in the image of God has God made mankind. A human life is that precious. But these cities are designated so that the accidental man or woman slayer cannot be cheaply and unjustly disposed of themselves as if their life didn't matter. The sanctity of life's high on God's values. And actually, even more strikingly, when you look at the details of the chapter, did you see how seriously even the accidental death of a person is taken? Because the cities of refuge were a place of safety, but they were also a place of exile. You could flee there, but you had to stay there. Look at verse 6. They are to stay in that city until they've stood trial before the assembly and until the death of the high priest who's serving at that time. Then they may go to their own home in the town from which they fled. And it's made clear elsewhere that if before that time you were found outside the city boundaries, you were fair game, so to speak, for the avenger of blood. So you see, these cities were both refuge and prison. The reminder's starkly given, isn't it, that human life, life made in God's image, always remains exceedingly sacred. What a contrast to some of the countries in the world today where life seems so cheap. You know, in this country, we mention a phrase like health and safety, and everyone instantly rolls their eyes, don't they? We all know the stories of excessive bureaucracy that have stopped us doing what we've all safely done for 20 years. Apart from the health and safety inspectors, they're rolling their eyes at us, rolling their eyes at them. And they probably realize, if they've traveled at all, that if in some countries there were just one or two basic health and safety rules, if there was just a sliver of responsibility and care shown to employees, it would mean that their lives had some value and significance. If the provisions of this chapter show the value God puts on human life, what's it got to say to a government that, as ours has apparently done, relaxes even more the steps needed to get an abortion? Or to those repeatedly pushing for freedom to allow assisted suicide? It certainly feels as if different values are at work in our culture today. And there's more to come. It's around that strange idea, I don't know whether you spotted it, of having to wait in the city of refuge until the death of the high priest. Now, Numbers 35, which is really the background document that fills in all the gaps, speaks of ransoming a man's life by monetary compensation. There are some Muslim cultures today where the idea of blood money is still rife. On payment of money, on payment of enough money, the victim's family forgives the murderer and he goes free. Well, God's word forbids that kind of blood money, that kind of ransom in these cases. No ransom for murder. The only satisfactory acceptable payment is the murderer's life. Any other sum is too cheap. Only that, life for a life, it says, will purge away the pollution murder brings on the land. And no ransom for this kind of accidental manslaughter either. You have to wait until the high priest dies. And the cities the Levites were based in included all six cities of refuge. The Bible doesn't explain why, but it's as if only the high priest's death can release the prisoner from his exile and bring him home again. And if that was the idea sown into the structure of God's law, it was an idea that would grow into full bloom with our great high priest Jesus. Am I a rebel? Am I just caught up in one of life's accidental tragedies? Well, come to the cross as your city of refuge, and you'll find the high priest who's died for you, who'll bring you home from your exile from God, and who'll do all of that without diminishing the huge value God puts on human life. Cities of refuge are God's justice and God's values. And also, as we look at these chapters, they speak of God's faithfulness. I mean, turn to those last verses, that final paragraph of chapter 21, verses 43 to 45. Now, the finishing touches are complete now. He stands back and looks and sums up, and it's remarkable. See what he says in verse 43? So the Lord gave Israel all the land he had sworn to give their ancestors. Verse 45, not one of all the Lord's good promises to Israel failed. Every one was fulfilled. Look, let's get real. We're used to an age of half-truths and half-measures. So look again at verse 45. Imprinted on your mind, not one of all the Lord's good promises failed. Every one was fulfilled. I mean, how do we get our heads around a God like that? Because even while they're being delivered on, you didn't need to be a cynic to have doubts time and time again. The promises are first given to a childless Abraham. The only bit of the land that he enjoyed at the end of his life was his wife Sarah's cemetery, and he bought that plot himself. These promises had to survive years of slavery in Egypt. They had to survive Pharaoh's stubborn opposition. They had to survive the wilderness wanderings. And God looks up and says, not one of them failed. Every one fulfilled. There is an unstoppability to God's faithfulness to his word. It will be done. But I think we struggle to handle that. We're short on experience of someone whose promises can be trusted will be kept. So we get tentative with the giving of our trust. Some of us can see all the difficulties and barriers and costs all too clearly and the unstoppability of God's faithfulness all too dimly. Our kids are all married, grown up, left home now, but when they were young, there was a time when all three of them were under three, and a good friend used to come over a couple of times a week just to help Claire looking after them, and she had about a 45-minute drive, but one day she was an hour or more late. And when she got there, she said that what had happened is she got to within about 10 minutes of our house and suddenly remembered. She'd promised one of her daughters that next time she came, she'd bring a doll with her. And she realized she'd forgotten. So she turned round, drove half an hour back through the traffic, picked up the doll, came all the way back to our house because she said she wanted our daughter to know that a promise would be kept. A promise could be relied on. I suspect our daughter's probably long since forgotten that. I haven't. We've got a God whose promise will be kept and can be relied on. He didn't have to turn round to be sure of that. But Jesus stepped down knowingly from heaven and set his face to go to the cross so that he could deliver. Not one promise failed. Every one was fulfilled. See, I wonder if we really do have our heads round it. Live as the enemies of God, and we will face his justice. Flee to his cross and to him for refuge, and we will taste his mercy. But too often, I suspect, we see the promise and close the book. We see the promise and, you know, we have the cynic sniff here, a likely story. Or the promise gives us a warm feeling when we're somewhere like in here, but it gets blown away in the reality of the world outside. And instead, we're to cling to it as a promise that is the ultimate reality, that is the ultimate certainty that comes from this God, this can be relied on God. Not one promise failed. Every one was fulfilled. Is that how you view God? It's how the writer of our final hymn did. "Great is your faithfulness," he wrote. Let's stand and sing of it.